Speaking of that, though, trying not to try. This is something I've always tried to do in my life. It's kind of Zen, and I'm kind of Zen. I was a Zen Judas for many years before it became popular, and it never did. But Edward, or Ted, if you want to call him that, Slingerland is in Vancouver, B.C., and he is the man who is sort of the father of the art and science of spontaneity and doing things apparently for no reason. I can't figure out what it is. It's very Zen, and it's kind of interesting, and it's all based in Chinese philosophy going back many years. He's on the phone with us right now from Vancouver. Can I call you, Ted?
Yeah, please.
Hi, Ted. How are you?
Good, good.
Yeah. Have you ever been mistaken for Herb Brodsky? Because I have your picture here, and I have a friend, Herb Brodsky, and you look very much like him.
Yeah, maybe he's my twin brother.
Yeah. He's in Denver selling coffee, but I thought...
All right.
So trying not to try is, of course, impossible, as all these things are, right? I mean, effortless effort, you can't do it.
It's a paradox, yep.
A paradox. Even having a paradox and not having a paradox, is it possible?
Yes.
So what good does it do us then, Ted?
It's good to know about the paradox. So, you know, the tension you have when you're trying to relax, you're trying to be spontaneous, you're trying to be happy. Yeah. There's a basic tension built into it that these early Chinese thinkers were very much concerned with. Uh-huh. So I think part of the advantage of looking at it is that they spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get around it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, my theory is that it still goes on today in China and that the Confucianists are now the communists.
Yes.
Because they're the ones who tell you what your behavior should be.
Uh-huh.
And the capitalists are the Taoists.
Huh.
What do you think about that?
The capitalists are the Taoists.
Yeah, because they are the ones who see the maneuvering ability along with the norms.
Huh. Interesting.
I think you got a treatise there, Ted. I'm happy to hand it over to you.
That's the next book. I think I'm going to run with that.
Yeah,
no, it's very interesting. The comeback of Confucianism in China is interesting. I think they figured out the whole Maoism thing wasn't quite working out, so they needed something new. So this is the new official Chinese policy, is we're all Confucians.
And this all goes back to
the idea of effortless action or trying not to try. You know, it's a state. So the early Confucians and Taoists all wanted to attain this state. So when you're in Wu Wei, it's kind of like being in the zone if you're an athlete, or this idea of flow. So you lose a sense of yourself as an agent. You're relaxed. You don't really notice you're doing anything, and yet everything works out perfectly. So it's kind of like being, you know, if you're a comedian, really being on, and just all the jokes are working.
Yeah. But if you're not a comedian, it means being totally obnoxious.
Exactly.
And horrible to be around.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. So actually, it's the opposite. So people like people who are in Wu Wei. So if you're in this state, you're relaxed, you're successful, but you also radiate this kind of charisma. So that in Chinese, unfortunately, it's pronounced duh, which sounds a little bit dorky, but it means something like charismatic
duh.
Power.
You radiate duh,
which doesn't sound very appealing when you put it that way. But it's this kind of, I think we all know this, the kind of charisma that people kick off when they're relaxed. When they seem like they're, you know, having a good time, they're comfortable with who they are. We like people like that.
Yeah.
So they all wanted to be in this state of Wu Wei, get this power, because for them it was the key to ruling effectively. Or if you were a Taoist, it was the key to kind of moving effectively through the world and having people leave you alone. Yeah. People make way for you. So they want to get this power, they want to be in this state, but there's this tension of if you're not relaxed, if you're not confident, how do you make it happen?
Yeah. And this all goes back to a butcher.
Yeah, so I think one of the best illustrations of this state is this butcher Ding, who's cutting up this ox for this lord in this ceremony. And he moves his blade, it seems like magic. He kind of doesn't touch any bones, doesn't touch any ligaments, and the ox just falls apart at his feet. And some people are horrified by the butcher story. I had a lot of vegetarians in my class who wanted to be named the poor ox. I thought that was very nice.
It's a metaphor.
The point of the story is that actually butchers were the lowest of the low in Chinese society. So part of the point of the story is the shock value, that this lord is watching this, the lowest of the low, this butcher cut up an ox, and yet it's the butcher who is really the Taoist adept who really knows how to move through life. And at the end, the butcher explains how he basically stops thinking, he shuts off his mind, he shuts off his senses, and he can just let his spirit guide him through the ox.
Yeah.
And the Lord says, you know, from the words of this butcher, I've learned the secret to living my life.
Yeah. So did he give him a position after that, or is he still the butcher?
Yeah, I think the problem is he's stuck being a butcher.
Yeah, okay.
But he's a really good butcher.
Always a downside to these revelations.
Yeah, there's always a downside to these stories. So
you know, what's interesting, though, that I read something about they found these very earliest stone implements, and they were butchering tools, and they concluded that all teaching began from butchering. Because they had to show people how to use the tools. And that was the first actually teaching was showing what you do with these tools that we have here.
Yeah, and how to make them. They're actually...
Yeah, how to make them.
These axes are very tricky to make as well.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
So the origin of teaching goes back to butchers as well. So butchers are pretty important, I guess.
Yeah, they're everywhere. But, yeah.
Conclude this. You've been described as a Canadian hedonist.
By whom?
My wife. I don't know. I saw it somewhere. And I'm wondering what that would be exactly. You know,
a Canadian. Yeah, we. There's not a whole lot of us up here because it's kind of cold.
A Canadian
originally
seeker. Are you a pleasure seeker or something?
Yeah. So this is this comes up in the book in terms of this difference between flow and this idea of wu-wei. So a lot of people see the parallels between them. The idea of you get absorbed in what you're doing, you're very effective. The difference is for this idea of, you know, Csikszentmihalyi's idea of flow. So this was popularized in the 70s.
Yeah.
For him, he thinks it's all about challenge, essentially. So it's about being in a situation where your skill perfectly matches the situation. So you don't get bored because it's not too easy. You don't get frustrated because it's not too hard. And you get in this flow state. And it really accurately describes kind of sports or people who are, you know, seeking out new rock climbing challenges. But what I don't think it fits is a lot of situations where people...
In Canada.
Yeah, what we do in Canada. You know, curling, it doesn't really fit curling.
It doesn't. So, curling's very zen, though, isn't it?
It's very zen. Yeah. So it doesn't capture situations where really the reason you're getting into this state is because you're absorbed in something that you care about. So it's about the... What I find helpful about this Chinese idea of wu-wei is the defining characteristic is you're absorbed in something that you value, something that you care about.
Okay.
And so that's why we like it. We like people who are relaxed or absorbed in something they care about, because then we feel like, you know, they're part of something that we can care about as well.
So what are these things you're doing that you care about?
That I care about? Wine, gardening, kayaking.
Oh,
the part of this all comes out in terms of, it, for the Chinese, it's very easy what you care about. You care about the Tao. So they believe in this kind of mystic, cosmic way. So one of the issues is if we want to update this concept, what does it mean for us? So what's the bigger framework that we want to get absorbed in when we're in wu-wei? And I think if you've got traditional religious beliefs, there's, you know, it could be your church or whatever it is you believe in, but it presents kind of a problem for people like myself who don't have traditional religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for a lot of us, the value systems we get absorbed in when we're relaxed and we're in wu-wei are kind of, you know, they're this kind of pastiche. We cobble them together from different things. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, cobble together their own spirituality. They take a little bit of Buddhism here. They take a little bit of Judaism here. They take a little Kabbalah, right?
Yeah.
Kind of mix and match spirituality. So some people do it that way. Other people just do it through moving from activity to activity that give them a kind of deeper satisfaction.
You know, so I see one, you know, kind of a disturbing analogy to this today.
Yeah.
In adopting someone else's cultural systems, this whole ISIS thing, where you have these kids who have no knowledge of this culture whatsoever, and suddenly they are devout in this particular branch of this religion, an entirely foreign cultural system, and are absorbed into it and total believers in it.
Yeah.
Isn't that similar to what you're saying, really?
That is. I mean, people want to be absorbed in something bigger than themselves. And so the danger is if you don't have these kind of activities, people you care about, you find it somewhere else. And so people, I think a lot of people who maybe are growing up in isolated situations, they don't have a good social group, they don't have a strong network of friends, they get attracted to these kind of... you know, it's an instant-made framework, and it's instant meaning and instant camaraderie, right? You're suddenly part of some bigger thing.
Yeah. And this thing about spontaneity, though, isn't it sometimes just more of a disorder than it is a noble pursuit?
I don't think so. So that's why spontaneity is not a great translation. So I really try to use the term wu-wei. We have to use spontaneity in the title because nobody knows what wu-wei is. But, you know, spontaneity in English implies this kind of... oh, you know, I spontaneously decided to blow off work and go to the beach. So I'm kind of self-indulgent or kind of bubbly. But for Uwe is really about being in touch with the way the world really is. So when you're in Uwe, you're actually seeing the world the way it really is, and you're engaging with it effectively. Mm-hmm. So it's really, in some ways, it's the opposite of what spontaneity in the West means.
Okay. Or either get out of Uwe, because you're in my way.
Yeah, I'm in Uwe. Watch out.
Yeah. but it's, as you say, it's a paradox. So how can you try not to try to do this?
Yeah. So the tension, the best way to get a sense of the tension is this game I talk about in the beginning of Try Not to Try. It's called Mind Ball.
Right.
And it's at my local science museum. You get sitting at either end of a table. You have this EEG sensor on your forehead. And it's basically picking up alpha and theta waves. Mm-hmm. So this is the brain activity you kick off when you're relaxed. And the more alpha and theta waves you produce, the more force you push on this little metal ball that's between you on the table. So the goal is to push the ball to the other end of the table, and you do this by basically out-relaxing your opponent. And it's incredibly hard to do. The first time I played, I was, you know, I sat down and I thought I was going to be really good at it because I study Uwe. I wrote a book about Uwe. I'd be really good at mind ball. And I just got crushed by the neuroscientist who runs the exhibit. And one of my big mistakes was, you know, we were playing for about 5 seconds and I opened my eyes and I saw that I was winning. The ball was moving down toward her end of the table. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, I'm winning. And the ball turned around and started coming back toward me. And I was like, oh, no, stop trying. And it started moving faster and landed at my side, and I lost. So this, what I like about mind ball is it kind of collapses into this microcosm, this tension of how even in a situation where you know, so there are a lot of situations in life where we know we do best when we're relaxed, confident, when we're not trying. But if you're not in that state, how do you cause yourself to get into it?
Yeah.
How do you consciously try?
And the answer is you can't, apparently.
The answer is you can't directly.
Yeah.
So one of the things I look at is why, from a modern cognitive scientific perspective, it really is a paradox. And essentially you're trying to use your cold cognition, the part of your brain that's in charge of communicating with other people and also making conscious decisions. That's the part of the brain that needs to shut down, but it's the part of the brain you're using when you know you need to shut down. So you're trying to shut down the thing that you're actually using. So it is directly a paradox. Mm-hmm. But most of what I basically do is walk people through the various strategies the early Chinese philosophers came up with to get you past the paradox. And most of them involve kind of trying to distract yourself or use your body as a tool for getting around a genuine mental paradox.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the story of the big gourds is instructive, don't you?
Yeah, no, I love that story.
Yes.
So that's, again, from the Zhuangzi. The Zhuangzi is one of the best sources of stories about Uwe. Mm-hmm. But that's about the kind of flexibility you have when you're in Uwe. So he has this friend who's a logician, kind of uptight by the book, and he gets these gourd seeds and grows them, and they turn out to be these huge gourds. And he tries to use them as bowls, and they're too shallow. He tries to use them as a spoon, and they're too unwieldy. So he says to his friend Zhuangzi, you know, I smashed them because they were useless. And Zhuangzi says, well, you certainly have a lot of undergrowth in your head. You're too, and basically the guy, he's trapped by social categories. So those are the spoons and bowls are the two things that gourds are used for in early China. Mm-hmm. And that's all he can think of. And Zhuangzi says, why didn't you make him into a raft and float around on the waters and lakes? So this kind of, when you're in a state of Uwe, you also get freed from preconceptions about how the world should be. Yeah. And you can actually really respond to it effectively and flexibly in a way that kids can and people who are relaxed can, and actually people who have had a couple drinks can. One of the things I look at in that section is some evidence that if you can kind of down-regulate your conscious mind, you actually are more successful in certain types of tasks that require creativity or lateral thinking.
Yeah, well, that's very much the Wisconsin idea of drinking to attain a spiritual state.
Those long winters, you guys really get into some Uwe.
Yeah, it doesn't matter time of year so much. It's just the idea of you can attain Uwe.
Yeah.
If you drink enough.
If you drink enough. So, and actually, Zhuangzi uses the metaphor of being drunk on heaven.
Yeah.
So it's a very powerful metaphor for him. But, of course, it's a metaphor, really, for the state you should be in.
Yeah. So the gourds are good. I do like, you know, in terms of a musician or an athlete or something, you could see how you could retrain the way you react. Mm-hmm. And that would be my, like, I love the Charlie Parker quote, you don't play the saxophone, you let the saxophone play you.
Yeah, that's the idea. So the feeling you have in Uwe is that the world is actually doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, or the game, you know, if you're an athlete, the game is moving you around. Or if you, you know, do a radio show, presumably it involves this kind of balance between being relaxed and letting the show go the way it's going to go, but also exerting some control. You need to intervene when it's time to intervene.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
Yeah, exactly.
This, right?
This boring academic talking too much. See you later. So that's the, you know, it's this, if it goes well, you feel like you didn't do anything, right? Mm. You feel like actually the show just kind of ran itself. That's the ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I don't have to do any work, that's a workless work to me.
Yes. It's appealing, right?
It's just a way of life, actually. Are some, you know, we still come down to the thing of, this is almost impossible to, would be great to be this way, to be spontaneous in the good sense of just acting as circumstances dictate, sort of, and correctly, because that's the Confucian one. So there's that. But I mean, how do you get there? You know, are some people just born that way? They have those instincts. We call it instinctual, sort of.
I think some people are probably born that way in certain areas of their lives, but I don't think anyone's born that way in every situation. So you've got to train it. So all these strategies assume that you got to start with some training. So and that's what the Confucians really continue to emphasize, is the training part of it.
Yeah.
I think where the Taoism comes in is at a certain point, you've trained yourself, and you need to learn to let go and trust your embodied knowledge, trust the fact that your body knows what to do. And that's when athletes choke, or when, you know, you choke in an interview, you know, presumably you're in a job interview, if you're qualified for the job, you've got the training you already need. The key is just to relax into it and go with the situation and not get too uptight. We're often not very good at doing that. So one of the important things I think about looking at the ideal of Wu Wei is we live in a society where we're really trained to, if we run into a roadblock, just try harder. You know, we're always trying to strive harder and faster and work more. And we surround ourselves with stimuli. We've got our smartphones and we're always tweeting and checking email and doing these things. And I look at my students and they're just, they don't have any downtime at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that they don't realize that in a lot of situations, the only way to really do well is to create space and let your intuition and your embodied skills take over.
Yeah, and for the sports skills, I think you talk about the putt and the pendulum. That's instructive about.
Yeah, that's a great study. So this is a very famous study by the late Dan Wegner, where they told people they had pretty skilled college golf players putting. And in one condition, they said, you know, try to get it in the hole, but no matter what you do, don't overshoot. And those people overshot. So
right.
You tell people to do something, not to do something, they do it. Don't think of a white bear. You can't not think of a white bear.
Right.
So this is the paradox, right? And so people don't, you know, I see my students, they've got a paper due or something, and there needs to be creativity. They've got to write something interesting. And instead of actually giving themselves time to think about it, they just sit in front of a computer and pull all-nighters and stare at the cursor blinking there. And they often don't make progress because they don't know how to stop trying when it's time to stop trying and kind of let spontaneity do its thing.
Yeah.
Good kind of spontaneity.
But the pendulum in the swing itself. Talk about that for a moment.
Oh, the same thing with the pendulum. You tell people who are holding a pendulum not to let it swing in a certain axis. So don't let it swing horizontally. Don't let it swing vertically. And that's precisely what they do.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of...
So should you give them the opposite of what the correct answer is or correct action?
Yeah, one therapy strategy that came out of this, Viktor Frankl used this paradoxical therapy where he actually, people who had insomnia, he said, okay, well, lie in bed and really try to stay awake. That seemed to help, actually. People who are trying to stay awake will fall asleep. Sometimes you can use this, or people can help you use it to your advantage.
Yeah. You can outsmart yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what a lot of the Taoist strategies are about, kind of trying to use your body as a way to outsmart yourself to get around this paradox.
Yeah, of course, one thing arises. I mean, what if the Chinese were wrong?
Uh-huh. Well, that's, I mean, what I'm arguing is that...
There could be a Vedic or an Indian solution that's actually the correct one, and the Chinese had it all wrong to begin with. Then we're up another tree here.
Yeah, no, I really think so. The reason I like looking at this period, the Warring States in China, is when all the early native forms of Confucianism and Taoism get formulated, is that they're basically exploring all the logical possibilities you can come up with. And you do see parallels. So like in the Hindu tradition, the Bhagavad Gita, you have something that looks exactly like the paradox of Wu Wei. So you can only attain the fruits, you can only get good achievements if you're not attached to them. You can only win if you're not trying to win, essentially, is what Arjuna is told by a Hindu deity. And so it's the same tension. You can only win if you're not attached to winning. And so what do? You fast, you do meditation. The strategies look a lot like the ones that the early Chinese were articulating. And one of the things I also argue in the book is it's the stuff makes sense from a contemporary perspective. So one thing we're learning about the mind is that we do have this very, if we're well-trained at least, we have these very powerful, intuitive ways of engaging with the world. And it's very clear that they're interfered with once we start using our conscious mind.
Right.
Our conscious mind is good for some things, but there's also times when it needs to get shut down. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not something that's really highlighted in recent Western philosophy, which tends to emphasize, control and thought and rationality. So that's why I think the early Chinese material is a really helpful resource.
Well, I just have one more thing to ask you, Ted. Is all this going to be on the final?
Yes, it's all going to be on the final, but don't try too hard to study.
Oh, okay. And can you just write that on the final, and then as you get an A, then I say, I don't know.
Yeah, every year I always have some student turn in a blank paper.
I tried, but I didn't do it, so it was very successful.
Yeah. And I say, that's great, you're not attached, so I'll give you an F, since you're not attached to grade.
Trying not to try. Edward Ted Slingerland up there in Vancouver. Thank you very much. Nice speaking with you.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show.
You betcha.